The chair calls the Education Policy Committee for Tuesday, March 25th, 2025 to order. And we have a quorum present. We do have a quorum present. Chair Jordan, have you had a chance to review the minutes? And if so, could you, that's a minutes for Wednesday, March 19th, 2025. Could you move to the approval of the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair. I have reviewed the minutes, and I would move approval of the minutes from March 19th of 2025.
Thank you. Chair Jordan to move, moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The ayes have it, and the minutes for Wednesday, March 19th, 2025 are approved. All righty. So Representative Quam has got the first bill up here. It's first bill is House File 69. Chair Quam, welcome to the committee. The chair moves House File 69 before the committee. And Chair Quam, please present your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I had someone, a professor, contact me with, he had done some studies, and so I dropped off a copy and put my initials on there. This bill will help save money at some schools and also increase the engagement of the community with the schools, and that actually is sort of outlined in the handout in that when you have on-cycle elections, you have generally twice or more community participation in the voting. And having been a school board member with having to do school elections outside of the regular election time, there's a cost, and you ended up not having as many locations and polling locations open, so that you know, a lot of the community felt as if it wasn't as participative. So that is the whole intent of this, is the small portion of schools that would, I believe earlier, I think I heard five districts maybe do odd year, but by switching to the normal even year general election, you get more people participating, and the school doesn't have to pay for the elections on their own. And that's the general intent of the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Quam. And we do have a couple of testifiers, one of which is remote. I will remind testifiers to state your name and organization for the record and keep your comments to about 2 minutes. So our first testifier is Jim DeMay. And Mr. DeMay, while you're walking up, I'll just tell you that many years ago in the eighth grade, I attended the Mounds View schools. So for 1 year.
Wonderful.
Good
which school?
School district. It's been too long, but I was in eighth grade. It was like a middle school of some
okay,
sort.
Okay, Johanna Edgewood, Chippewa, perhaps. I don't
that was
we
too
haven't
many,
built
too many
a new school
ago.
Since 1974. So,
okay, well. But anyway, go ahead and tell us who you are.
Okay, my name is Jim DeMay. I'm an elected school board member in what I sometimes jokingly call the somewhat independent school district 621 or the Mounds View Public Schools. I also serve as the vice chair of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts this year. I have been involved in the Mounds View Public Schools one way or another since 1971. I was born in a neighborhood. I went to my neighborhood schools, chose to go back and be involved, and my kids went to those same school. I now serve as an elected school board member, and I would really like to thank you all for your support for the public schools. The public schools in Minnesota are gems, and we feel very strongly supported by the legislature. I am here today, though, to testify against House File 69, or the bill requiring school elections to be held on uneven years. As a local elected official, I'm very sensitive to mandates from the state or the federal government. We operate in a myriad of rules and regulations. Well, all are well-intentioned and many proper. These mandates erode local and community control. Some mandates are costly, some are not. Some make good sense, and some are overreach. It often is a matter of where you sit. We have a long history of odd-year elections in the Mounds View School District. It appears to work well for us. Odd-year elections allow our community to focus upon school issues. Our most recent election in the fall of 2023 fielded 11 candidates for 4 seats. Our local Lions Club, our local League of Women Voters, our parent-teacher organization hosted forums. The debate was vigorous, and they were well-intended and attended, and they were covered by the local newspapers and our cable outlets. It was a vigorous debate, and participation was great. Our voter turnout was strong. Over 14,000 people voted, with the Mounds U School Board being the only issue on the ballot. In comparison, the presidential primary in 2024 fielded it less of a turnout than our local school board election. When it comes to costs, the Ramsey County Elections Bureau administered our election in 2023 for the annual cost of $28,600. So that's what it costs us every 2 years. Our school leaders see it as a modest price to pay for every 2 years for an election system that operates well for our community. From what I know, I probably have a different number than Representative Quam, about 25 school districts still choose, and you as a legislature have given us a choice to choose when our elections are, about 25 do it on the odd year. Our fear of moving in the even year elections is having our local school issues be buried on the ballots. We fear we're going to become like judges. Some school districts do prefer even year elections. That is their local choice, and I respect that choice. Mounds U is different from Murray County, and we choose to have a focused local debate about our school district every 2 years. We are the only office on the ballot, and the school districts get top billing, and we like it that way. Even year ballots have presidents, governors, Congress, state legislators, and many other offices on a long ballot. I read an article recently that the Minnesota 2026 U.S. Senate race may cost over $50 million. And as you all well know, a state house race costs about $90,000 without the independent expenditures. In Mounds U, our successful local school board races historically spend about $4,000 or $5,000 involving yard signs, a lit piece, local internet, newspaper advertising, and plenty of door knocking. It is a community event. Local school board races will struggle to get resources to compete with these massive campaign expenditures, and our focus on school issues once every 2 years could be lost. In my 5 years of service on the Mounds U School Board, I have never once been challenged by a voter on our odd-year election system. Many have challenged my priorities and qualifications to sit on the school board, many, but I do have numerous in constant inquiries about curriculum, school lunches, start times, mental health, cell phones, standardized tests, class sizes, bus service, college prep, school-to-work programs, and extracurricular activities, the exact issues we discuss every 2 years in my community. In closing, the present system of choice works for my district and my community. School issues get top priority, front and center, every 2 years. Our community participates. We field a wide variety of candidates, and people do vote. So please protect our right for local choice in a system that works well. Thank you for the opportunity for me to provide input.
Thank you. And next we have remote testifier Greg Abbott.
Hello. Well, thank you, Chair Bennett, and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Greg Abbott. I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association, as well as the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. We are in opposition to House File 69 because we feel it is an unnecessary mandate that further erodes local control of school districts. School districts already have a clear and established process set by the legislature to determine their school board election years, making this bill not necessary. The history of school districts choosing between odd and even year elections goes back to the 1990s when the legislature wanted to move May school board elections to November. As part of that agreement, schools were granted the flexibility to choose either even year or odd year elections, whichever election cycle best suited their local community. At the time, 168 chose odd year elections, 172 opted for even year. In 2005, the federal government passed the Help America Vote Act. It required special voting machines, moved elections to optical scan systems. It required public testing of equipment, renting machines. It made the process more complex and more costly. In the past 20 years, all but 23 school districts out of 331 have moved to even year elections, including three school districts in the cities of the first class. It is puzzling in this part of the bill that says the legislature trusts the locally elected school boards in Duluth, Rochester, Minneapolis, and St. Paul to make that decision on whether they think odd year or even year elections are best, But that same trust isn't there for the same locally elected school boards in the other 23 school districts. This bill would force those districts into even year elections, breaking the contract set when school elections were moved from May to November. It is also an unnecessary mandate that erodes the decision of the local community. Those 23 districts have stuck with odd year elections because they believed keeping the nonpartisan races out of a very partisan even year election system gives people a better understanding of who is running and keeps the focus of odd year elections on school issues. If you look at some of the vote cast spreadsheets from counties like Hennepin and Wright, you will see there's a 75% turnout for the partisan races. But when you look at voting in city, county, and school races, you'll see a very large number of undervotes, people who didn't vote at all in those races or voted for maybe one candidate out of four. Turnout for nonpartisan races, in essence, is lucky to hit 50% and could be lower in some races. This mandate is not needed when only 23 of the 331 districts remain in odd year elections. The legislature has trusted school districts for 30 years to make this decision. We don't believe there's any evidence that this flexibility has created problems or confusion. A mandate to force the remaining districts into even year elections is unwarranted and disrupts a system that is already functioning very well. MSBA believes the legislature should keep that trust with our locally elected school board members. Thank you for allowing us to testify on this issue.
Thank you to the testifiers. That concludes our public testimony. Members, do we have any discussion? Representative Lawrence.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know I have a question that doesn't affect education policy, but something that is very important to me is townships. And does this bill exempt townships so that they can still have their elections on Township Day, would be my question.
Representative Quam?
There was discussion of exempting entities, you know, cities, counties, et cetera, below a certain level was the idea, and that would include the townships. But I you know, you heard 25, 23 for the schools. I believe when the I think it was a township, when the township group said there were five that were doing odd outside of the cities of the first class.
Thank you.
But I can talk to you offline and on the amendments we're looking for that for smaller local government.
Thank you. And Representative Lawrence, just a reminder, we're just going to focus on the education components, but if you have a quick follow-up, that's fine.
Madam Chair, yeah, I was just going to encourage that. I know most townships have their elections in March, second Tuesday of March, and I guess if you talk with the association, that'd be, I'd like that. Thank you for yielding.
You're welcome. Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I'm just, yeah, I think the testifier from the MSBA brought this up, but it was something that I had a question too when I was reading it. What's the rationale behind exempting first class cities from this particular legislation?
Representative Chair Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I was a freshman, I discovered that there's quite a bit of statute differences and set-asides in regards to the city of the first class, because Rochester became a city of the first class, and there were things that impacted school districts that had part of their district in the city of the first class, and there was special regulations to that. So when it was drafted, it was, you know, saying city of the first class already have all these special little tweaks, including school districts involved in them. Therefore, I was excluding that to, you know, basically get down to the point of local government, schools, cities, etc. If you have more people coming to the election, which, you know, the sheet was to indicate a study done in fact, talks about California, Arizona, and other states as well. But if you get more people showing up for the election instead of say, a third or less, then at least they feel that their voice has been heard. But you have a lot of people that don't show up. And in school districts, they tend not to pay close attention until they're upset about something, which a lot of times is sports. But they then they come and they get involved. So a lot of times people aren't informed and don't think to come in for an odd year election. And generally, when I was doing school board, you know, involved with that, and we had elections not during the even year general, we had fewer and sometimes different polling locations. And so this way, you'd be using the same polling locations. You would save the money because there are other things on the ballot, and you have more people showing up. And, you know, again, if there's some indication from a testifier that not everybody's aware of who the candidates are, so they undervote, at least they had a chance and the privilege to vote in that election.
Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that explanation. You know, you mentioned, you know, special statutes that you know, first-class cities tend to have. Hypothetically, any city could have special statutes that, you know, make it unique and special, which is why I would strongly advocate keeping this as a local control issue. I don't think that we need to fix a problem that doesn't exist. And so I appreciate you bringing this forward. But for me, this is I don't think I can vote to move this forward. I appreciate you, though. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. I appreciate it. And thank you, Representative Quam. Good to see you in another committee here today. I have two different questions that are related and unrelated in the same way. One is, so I served on the Edina School Board for 4 years. One of the things that we're seeing across the state and actually across the country is that it's getting harder and harder to find local candidates to run. It's a huge issue. Like in Edina, we had 16 candidates in 2017 and we had three for three spots in 2023. So one of the things that we talk about a lot too is making sure we have diverse voices at the table, all really important for our public school system. And so my question is, you know, you talked about, I like how you said that we want informed voters. And one of the things that we know when you are a candidate in a general election is the price of the campaign goes up. You are competing against presidential candidates, Senate, House, state level, federal level in different areas. And so you're competing there and the price goes up. Cost for an ad in a newspaper is higher. The cost for all of it and the competition to get even printed materials out are hard. When you land as a school board member with a mailer that lands with seven other mailers, your voters are not as informed. And so my question is, in doing this bill, did you give any consideration to those costs and the costs that would then need to be incurred by the community and by voters in order to support a local candidate?
Chair Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And since even the School Board Association, I think they basically indicated over 90% of the districts have elections during the even-numbered years. I'm very familiar with multiple local school boards and the Rochester School Board elections happening during a general election, and I haven't seen, you know, when I ran and in my school board election area in this past election, there wasn't huge dollars spent on there, but we had forums of where the candidates came and the public got to see. And so there was plenty of information that didn't cost one dime to any of the candidates. And I know multiple candidates that have been elected to school boards in the last few elections that didn't spend enough to even have to, you know, file and report with campaign finance. So it doesn't seem to be a huge issue and problem for over 90% of the districts. I'm just looking at trying to have at least 50% or more of the people showing up and voting on a school board, because I think that engages, is more likely to engage the public, and the buy-in of community is so key to successful school districts.
Representative Green.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Kwan. You know, I think to that point, like, that is why we would let local districts, I think, in local control and local school boards make their own decision for their community. In my campaign in 2019, the candidates that I competed against each spent over $35,000 per piece to run against me, and that was in a local school board. And that's not just in Edina, that's in a lot of different metro cities. So I appreciate you sharing that about Rochester. Maybe that's true in that district, but in other districts it looks different. And so that would be, to me, a reason why local control would be really important in this conversation, to allow schools to make their own choice. And then my second question is, you talked about Representative Gottfried, yeah, I know. Gottfried talked about statutes, but statutes in different cities. And so there are some cities that do have special statutes, like in Bloomington, the city that I represent, the voters have chosen to use ranked choice voting, very democracy-friendly way of voting. And so if they have, if they bring some of those local elections into the general election, is there money appropriated for those cities to be able to allow for extra ballots, or what have you considered that at all?
Chair Kwan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll try to be brief since it's not part of the education debate, but those cities are also already spending money for special ballots. So there wouldn't be an increase in cost, because actually it'd be a decrease, because now you have the people working during the general election. That cost is not all borne by the city for their special election. There are multiple funding streams that help cover the cost of equipment and materials. So even if they were doing ranked choice with a special ballot, which I assume would be required for ranked choice, they would still have the advantage of the people checking in, the books or tablets they're using for all of those things they're utilized are already there and covered for the general election. So if there's a cost, it'll be less cost than what it'd be on an odd year for that city.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. I disagree with you a bit on that, on the cost, because I think, the Secretary of State would need to be must be able to actually implement the ranked choice voting and that ability and that whole process. I just think it's something that we need to consider if we're telling local entities that this has to happen, because it does impact, even though this is education, it does impact other statutes that are in place and other decisions that local communities have made to support different ways of doing democracy. So,
Representative Elkiner.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. Thank you, Representative Kwan, for bringing this forward. I just wanted to ask, just kind of leaning in on the local control thing, and like, I kind of tend to believe, like Representative Godfrey said, this is a solution in search of a problem. Is it true that cities can, there's nothing stopping them from moving by themselves to an even year election? Is that true?
Chair Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's why the vast majority of cities do it during a in-cycle, even-year election.
Representative Elkiner.
Right. So I guess why are we – so there's been enough of a history of elections being carried out. Cities have made the choice to stay odd year if they want for a lot of reasons. I've talked to I represent part of Minnetonka. We have odd year elections for city council, school boards. They've chosen that because they want to have a specific local focus on local races, like Representative Green was talking about. Dissociate themselves from national politics, presidential politics, gubernatorial, Senate, what have you. So people can really focus on, okay, now it's time for know, we've had the crazy season. Now it's time for we can talk about Minnetonka and what is affecting our people here very locally, and have that as the issue. Why are you trying to take that away from Minnetonka, who chose that?
Chair Quam.
Well, thank you. If you look at the study and the published document summary, it's because when you have odd year off elections, a fraction of the people turn out to vote. And the study has indicated that there tends to be a greater possibility where a small portion of the electorate dominates, and there has been disenfranchisement of certain other portions of the population. And that is part of the reason why there was legislation in California to do that in order to make it more representative in the population that turned out to vote.
Representative Falconer, follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. Just one follow-up. I mean, I just can't, I guess, support just taking the control away from the cities and school boards that have chosen this. I mean, four states run their entire legislative elections in odd years, too. So it's not like this is a wild, crazy idea that some municipalities and school boards in Minnesota have implemented on their own. It's out there. It's been working. And I feel like we should allow local control to conduct their elections in the way that they choose. Thank you.
Chair Jordan, do you have some final comments?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Quam, for bringing the bill. I'm going to make some just points, and I hope you can address them in your closing just to keep things moving. I would encourage you to be a little bit more precise when talking about this bill. There are 23 school districts in the state of Minnesota that do these off-year elections. And they correspond to some of the largest districts in our state. Just because a city is a city of the first class doesn't mean that that's the largest school, that the school district isn't necessarily larger. So, for example, Anoka-Hennepin is the largest school district in the state, and they have off-year school board elections. So does Bloomington, Minnetonka, Roseville, Moundsview, and assorted others. Like, there's 23 different districts. So that's important to know. And so to this issue of costs, for the ranked choice voting issue, it doesn't mean that they will save costs because, for example, in Bloomington, they also have off-year mayoral and council races. So they're still paying for that. So there would be an additional cost to reprint those school board ballots in those on-year elections to use ranked choice voting. So that's just not accurate that it would save costs because the ballot would have to be printed that year for just school board elections. And to the other point about it being cheaper for school board races, the district that I represent, Minneapolis, had an outside PAC in 2024 spend over $300,000 on Minneapolis school board elections. And that money came from Michael Bloomberg. So these school board elections, even in on-year elections, are attracting significant outsized contributions. 10 years ago, it was $300K. Today, if an out-of-state millionaire or billionaire wanted to influence elections, they're still doing that. So I think when you talk about all these reasons to do that, they're not actually accurate. This isn't going to save money. It's going to cost money. It's going to take away school boards and school districts and cities and municipalities and voters and these cities' ability to have this influence over their school. So I just don't really see this be, I don't think this bill is ready, and I don't think it has been precisely talked about today. So I'd encourage you to do more work before this becomes law. Thank you.
Chair Quam, some final comments?
Yes, certainly. And Chair Jordan, if you actually read the bill, it would require the cities to have their elections during the even number, so you wouldn't be printing special ballots for an odd year election that's not happening. If you're already printing the ballot, it'd be in the even year. That's why it came up about other entities outside of the scope of this committee. So, yes, that would be no additional cost and very likely to have decreased cost. The other thing is in the metro areas is what this professor used a lot of information on his study, which indicated there was a disenfranchisement by having it at odd years that wasn't present when you went with on-cycle and the higher proportionality. But that's why I left this, is so you could look at it. I know the bill is not going to be moving on from here, but that way you can be more informed and be able to check that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Quam. And Chair Quam, or the chair lays over House File 69 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further consideration at a later date. Members, next we have House File 2372. And while Representative Mueller moves to the testifier table, get settled in, Representative Mueller moves House File 2372 before the committee with the chair's intention to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further consideration at a later date. So I'll let you get settled in there, Representative Mueller. Whenever you feel ready, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Bennett, and thank you, members of the committee, for hearing this bill. I'm excited to be able to give you and present to you House File 2372, which has broad bipartisan support. If you look at the research summary, it says Mueller and others. So there's lots of us. In fact, there's several of us in this committee that are on this bill from both sides of the aisle. Too many young people are graduating from high school without tools, confidence, or motivation to participate in our democracy. And in fact, 2 in 5 people feel even somewhat prepared to participate civically in this experience. So without intentional efforts to foster civic engagement, we risk a disengaged generation that feels disconnected from their communities. So one of the solutions is proposed in 2372 to have a civic seal. 12 states, including Kentucky, California, and Arizona, have already established a civic diploma seal to reward students who demonstrate the civic knowledge and engagement. And so in this bill, we are asking Minnesota to become number 13. A Minnesota civic seal would formally recognize students who go beyond the classroom to develop civic skills, strengthening our democracy or democratic republic for the long term. So in the bill, if you would look at the bill, what this does is that it will, the bill actually establishes through the Minnesota Civic Seal, they have a working group that would get together and would create the criteria development, that's in subdivision 2, and about what are some of the requirements to earn the Civic Seal. The school districts, after that's been completed, the school districts would have the opportunity to then decide how they would fulfill those requirements. So the Minnesota Civic Education Coalition, in partnership with the Minnesota Department of Education, will lead a working group of civic educators, students, and community members to define criteria. The working group will finalize the recommendations by June of 26. The program has no cost. However, we are hearing that there might be some cost to get insignia put on a diploma. I believe that as we look at that, this is, in the Senate, they came with a fiscal note of about $500,000. I'll check with, I almost called you Representative Farnsworth. You are not that. Sorry, Mr. Farnsworth, and I believe that is something that the department can absorb. They have not told me that, but I believe that is something that they can absorb. And so starting in 26-27 school year, this is when we could start earning the civic seal. Now, I would like to turn it over to my testifiers. I would say really up front, I know there has been a lot of discussion about what should be included, who should be included, how does this work. This is literally the definition of local control. And the reason why I say that is because while this group is going to create the criteria of how to get the civic seal, it's really the local school districts in response to the local communities that will decide the specific way to fulfill those requirements. And so, I think that that's going to give a broad perspectives and voices that will be able to be representative of their community. You have lots of letters of recommendation in here, and I would really like to point out the Minnesota Alliance with Youth with a former Chair Davney, and he just put it really succinctly in his letter about how they would really recommend that this criteria would be nonpartisan, project-based community involvement, self-reflection, honor and include the tribal governments, and all of that can happen. That doesn't need to be written in statute for that to happen. And so what we're trying to say is that these groups are going to just create the broad criteria, and then your local school district will be able to decide how they'll be able to fulfill that. I will also tell you, in talking with several of the Minnesota Civic Education Coalition, as people are concerned with how the criteria will be developed, I have asked them if they'd be willing to put in an amendment that would say they would be subject to open meeting laws, and they say are open to that idea as well. So if that's something that would give some comfort language to people, that would be something that we'd be willing to do. I know this is being laid over, Madam Chair, and so we can continue to work on that. But with that, I know we have several testifiers, so I'd like to yield my time to them, please.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Excuse me, we do have some public testimony, including student testifiers. For our students, you are not required to provide your last name. You may, as you wish, identify yourself with your first name and student. I will ask testifiers to keep your comments to 2 minutes. So can we first have Audrey, student from Moundsview High School, come on up. And Adonai, student from Chaska High School. Both up there together. And we'll start with, and just a reminder, keep your testimony or comments to 2 minutes, and go ahead and introduce yourself, Audrey.
Hi, thank you, Chair. My name is Audrey Stenzel. I'm a sophomore at Moundsview High School, and I'm here to advocate for the Civic Seal. I'd like to take a moment to share my experience in civics and why I think it's incredibly important for students to become involved and participate and advocate. Growing up, I faced many challenges. I was told to go draw instead of playing with science models. I was told we don't listen to girls while attempting to solve a biology problem. And once I joined youth in government, I was told that my problems were not serious enough to make a bill out of it. Throughout these issues, I consistently questioned myself and why I continued to persist. Once I joined civics, and specifically youth in government, I realized that I persist because the pushes didn't make me fall, but they made me stronger. I realized that if I didn't continue to fight, what if no one else did? I almost quit youth in government, but a voice inside of me told me that this is why I'm here. After deciding to stay in YIG, I was lucky enough to become appointed and then eventually elected into the Speaker of House position, and these positions have given me the drive and the passion to pursue a career in government and have shown me why we as a society need to have students engaged in civics. With a world forever changing, we need young people, the future of democracy, to stand up and understand how their government works and why it matters. House File 2372 will incentivize more students to pursue civics and provide opportunities for students to find their passion in civic engagement. I'd like to share a quick statistic with you all. According to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation, a survey discovered that over 70% of Americans fail a basic civil literacy test. They fail questions about the number of branches, but also on how our democracy functions and fails. Encouraging students to join civics will inspire more Americans to pursue public service, leading to a stronger, more confident nation. I urge you once again to support House File 2372 to create more opportunities to grow our civic youth for the future of our democracy and nation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Adonai from Chaska High School.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Adonai from Chaska High School, and I'm speaking in support of House File 2372. From being a part of school advisory committees to leading district multicultural events to being a part of the Minnesota Youth Council, I speak to you today as a kid who loves to be engaged in civics. Yet I wasn't always this passionate. Like many students, I had no incentive to get involved in the community and government issues. After all, I'm just a kid, right? What change could I make in this world? Sadly, this is the mindset of many students who don't get introduced to civic engagement opportunities. Because we haven't been presented with the opportunity to engage in our community as youth, we think that participating in our democracy is something that's left for the adults to do. After witnessing multiple racial incidents during my first few months in high school, I was tired of sitting silently and waiting for an adult to be engaged on my behalf, or wait to get older to actually have the authority to speak. But I realized that I didn't have to wait. I could be civically engaged at the age of 14 and take a stand against discrimination within my school. In realizing the power of becoming civically engaged, I was able to create a club, increasing understanding around different cultures in my school, and advocate for a required ethnic studies course at the state level. Yet I have paved my own hard, long pathway. And I wish when I started there was a clear roadmap to civic engagement. I wish there was an incentive that encouraged me whenever I doubted my authority to advocate for issues despite my young age. The Civic Seal is that incentive. It's a simple solution to provide a platform for high school students across the state to realize the power of youth voice and help create pathways to actively participate in civic engagement projects. If we don't invest in civic engagement now, we risk a future where young people feel disconnected, unheard, and unmotivated to participate. We threaten the very foundation of democracy when we don't provide opportunities for youth to understand the power to create change within the government. Minnesota, I urge you to support House File 2732 to give students an incentive to use their voice, create change, and move our democracy forward into a brighter future. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Brianna Harder. Good. And the other two can go ahead and take your seats elsewhere. And Brianna, go ahead and get yourself comfortable and then introduce yourself for the record. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairs Bennett and Jordan, co-chairs Mueller and Hill, and committee members, guests, and observers. My name is Brianna Harder. I am a social studies teacher at Camden High School, formerly known as Patrick Henry High School. That change made by students, that change advocated for, pushed for, and engaging with community around the name change was led by our students. And I'm quite excited to learn about an opportunity that students can earn a civic seal on their diploma should this bill become law. Throughout my career, and similar to many of my colleagues, each year I seek out opportunities for students to actively engage in political processes, to learn in real-world experiences what government looks like, sounds like, feels like, and can envision themselves in the seats that you're sitting in now. Over my 26 years of teaching, this has included things that develop knowledge and skills around civics, government, and people-powered political action, such as political forums, candidate panels, letter-writing campaigns, mock elections, mock legislative sessions like the one that was held here in December for the first time at our state capitol, and a variety of other things. I could go on and on and on about all of the amazing things that our students do in our school and classrooms. So when I say that, when we're seeing reports that say that teenagers are disengaged, politically ignorant, and disillusioned, I'm not seeing it. I see a very, very different level of engagement than those reports claim in our school. I see students who are active in student council, citywide student government, gathering research and presenting to communities through partnership with UROC and YPE. I see students participating in Model UN, urban debate. I see students volunteering with campaigns and lobbying for increased funding in a variety of different areas, greater access to ethnic studies courses, and increased numbers of educators of color in our classrooms across the state. Sometimes I'm even seeing students volunteer in things that they then become leaders in. And they don't necessarily know it until that spark is lit. Students all over Minneapolis are doing the same. I see it on a daily basis. So in short, despite these headlines, these polls, these cherry-picked data sets, our students are engaged. And they're participating in civic action all the time, and they care very, very deeply about being able to be more effective the next time they do this, and even more effective as they move into adulthood. These experiences they have are often transformative, as you heard. They inspire public service in the future. Students I talk to are starting to see themselves in the seats that you sit in, and higher, and lower. I've had conversations with students, if we were to hierarchy that, at the local school level. I do want to say that most of the students that I teach, I'm fairly confident that all of the juniors and seniors would already meet the four requirements, and many of my ninth graders would. So as we look at what we see is needed for a healthy and strong democracy, this is a way to incentivize both students and teachers to engage in increased civic engagement. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have a remote testifier, Landon, a student at Pacelli High School. Landon, are you there?
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. Good afternoon. My name is Landon. I'm a ninth grader at Pacelli High School in Austin, Minnesota, and I'm here today to advocate for the Minnesota Civic Seal. And that's a program that will not only recognize students who are actively involved in their communities, but also inspire future generations to engage in the civic process. When I first joined Youth in Government in eighth grade, I was amazed by how many students from across the state shared the same passion I had for civics. I'll never forget walking into my first conference surrounded by hundreds of other students who were ready to roll up their sleeves and do something. It made me realize that I wasn't alone in my desire to make a difference. And from that moment on, I was hooked. One of the most valuable lessons I've learned through Youth in Government is the importance of relationships and collaboration. In my first attempt to run for Speaker of Humphrey House, which is our model representatives for 9th and 10th graders, I didn't win, but I didn't see it as a failure. I saw it as an opportunity to learn. I realized that campaigning wasn't just about winning votes. It was about building genuine relationships with my peers. It was about earning their trust and showing that I cared about their ideas and perspectives. I learned that effective leadership isn't about flashy speeches or competing for attention. It's about connecting with others and working together to achieve common goals. In my second attempt, I took that lesson to heart and focused on engaging with my peers, listening to their bills, and building trust. It paid off as I won the position and was able to lead with a sense of purpose. Knowing that I had gained support, not through traditional campaigning, but through meaningful connections. During my time in Youth in Government, I've also had the privilege of collaborating on important bills like those addressing rural healthcare, veterans aid, and mental health resources in libraries. Through this civic exercise, students work together to craft language and offer amendments. We gain a better understanding not only of the issues facing our communities, but of potential solutions. Through this process, I've learned not just about the technicalities of drafting legislation, but about the power of collaboration and the importance of listening to others. This is why I believe the Civic Seal is so important. It would not only recognize the hard work and dedication of students, for example, my peers here, but it would also encourage others to get involved and start building those relationships. It would provide a platform for students to find their voice, contribute to their communities, and develop the skills needed to become leaders in the future. The Civic Seal is more than just recognition. It's about creating a culture of civic engagement where students are motivated to engage with their peers, build trust, and work together for positive change. I believe it will inspire future generations to take an active role in shaping the future of our state and our country. Thank you for considering the Minnesota Civic Seal.
Thank you to our testifiers. That concludes public testimony. And before we move on to member discussion, I just want to thank those students and, wow, amazing young people. And I want to give a shout out to programs like Youth in Government and Teen Pact, because when I run into students that are part of those programs, I see young people who have gained a ton of knowledge. They have such poise, like we've seen here in the testifiers, and they're engaging in one of the most important things, which is our government, our democracy, and civics. So appreciate that. So anyway, members, do we have some member discussion? Representative Gottfried.
Yes, thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing this forward. And again, shout out to all the speakers today. Thank you for engaging in this. I know I had the opportunity to meet Audrey with a group of students from Moundsview a month or so back, and I know they were talking about this program even back then. So appreciate your continued work on this. I did just want to quick point out just maybe a slight language discrepancy, even though I am supportive of this bill and look forward to advocating it being part of whatever omnibus we ended up passing. Line 1.21 specifically referenced the junior ROTC and then line 2.7 through 2.8 talks about no specific out-of-school or partisan civic program or provider shall be named or required as criteria. Now, I don't know if that is considered criteria, but maybe something that we potentially could just clean up if there's a bit of a discrepancy. Personally, I don't have an issue with junior ROTC being considered a part of the civic engagement, but maybe just something to keep in mind as we're cleaning up the bill going forward. Other members of my caucus or this committee may feel differently than me, but just something to potentially clean up. Thank you very much.
Representative Mueller, comments?
Thank you, Chair Bennett, and thank you, Representative Godfrey, for bringing, we're always looking for ideas as we're kind of putting this together. I'll tell you that this is as grassroots as it gets. I mean, these students are the ones who came to, and Landon, who you just heard, is the one who came to me. And from my district, emailed several times, called several times. Persistent. So finally just went to his school and just said, okay, we're going to hash this out. What's going on? And here we are, right? Like this is what happens, right? When you decide to get involved. And so I will tell you that the people who are going to put this together, the coalition, they're very open to suggestions. They're very open to making sure that as they start creating these criteria, that they, as I said, that's one of the reasons why they're so open to having open meeting laws, so that people can have input in these things. So I've written it down. The people who are the decision makers are in the room, and so they're listening to what you're having to say. Thank you, Representative Godfrey.
Follow up, Representative Godfrey?
Very little, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. Thank you. Let's get it done.
Okay. Chair Jordan, any final comments? Did somebody? Representative Bierman, missed you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to lift this up as well. Thank you for bringing the bill forward. The first conversation I ever had in this building was when I was elected. I came up and I met a fellow named Representative Dean Erdahl. And the work he was doing in this area to lift up the importance of teaching civics in high school, and I think this is a great add-on to his work, and I really appreciate you bringing it forward and the need for it and the reasons for it is, you know, to expand it to all kids and all ages. But appreciate the students here today. I met a few as well when they were here last week and really appreciate what your comments were. And thank you for your work and spreading the word among your peers. Thank you.
I don't miss anybody. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the bill. I want to start by saying I think civic engagement is critical. And I agree with what everybody said. I have an issue with the sticker being on high school diplomas. And I want to just kind of ask some questions so that I understand where we're going, if that's okay. So I'm going to have a couple questions, Chair. I guess the first question, and I came in late because I was presenting another bill, but is this bill intended to be laid over, or are we sending it to Ed Finance?
This will be laid over.
Okay.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. So there's no cost to this at all to create?
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. And Representative Keeler, when it went through the Senate, there was discussion about there being a cost to have the seal created and like putting a sticker on the diploma. That cost, and again, I have not physically asked MDE, but that cost seemed very minimal. And so while there is a fiscal note, I believe, in Senate, no, not yet. Okay. So we were told that there might be a cost. It went through the Senate. Senator Swadzinski is the person who's carrying it. And we were told there would be a potential cost to this. As of right now, we haven't been told. And again, if you would like me to submit it to a fiscal note, I believe this is one of those things where the department should be able to absorb that cost.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that. I mean, I do think that there's costs, right? Because, and if it's not from the department, it's from the schools, or it's from the pockets of the individuals who are going to participate in this. 1.9 says that one of the activities must involve in at least one engagement outside of the classroom. So when we talk about requiring kids to do things outside of the classroom to be able to earn something, we start to lean into a privileged population. Not every kid has access to go do things outside of the school day. So I just want to caution us of that. But then also, on the second page, so we look in like 2.17, because I'm sure you're following along with your notes, and down, it's the school participation. So a lot of these things are going to require somebody within the school district to maintain the records, to make sure that somebody's completed it, to actually put the stickers on diploma. I know that we say that, like, all those things should just be absorbed, but those are also the things that end up coming back from school districts to say those are unfunded mandates. And so what's happening is, because we're making it a voluntary option, school districts who are strapped, that adding an extra FTE to do this calculation or to follow along is putting more work on our school district. So what happens when we have a rural school district who doesn't have extra funding, who all of their staff is already, like, really busy with overloaded things? We all know, right, the line in, like, contracts that say other duties as assigned gets very long. I just get really nervous that we're going to keep it here and pretend like it's policy only when there's actually some costs that may trickle down to the school district deciding whether or not they want to do this. Now, why that is leaning me into a concern is that when I talk to individuals about this, the end goal is not actually just civic engagement. The end goal is that then this seal can be utilized for some sort of scholarship or benefit when they go to higher education. So now what we've done is a school district that maybe didn't have the financial or the FTE individuals to do what seems very simple, their kids are now at some sort of disadvantage because they didn't have the tools to put a seal on a high school diploma. Where I think a lot of what we're talking about, the civic engagement, absolutely, get involved. I think that's stellar. I think, too, though, to determine what you've done, we do that a lot with volunteering. You document all your volunteering. You do letters of recommendation. Like, there's still a lot of things that we can get out this. I just think we need to be a little bit more mindful of how we actually set this up with a pot of money that if schools want to do this, kids can get scholarships to be able to leave and do things outside of just the classroom so they can earn this. That there's opportunities that if a school says they really want to do this, but their FTEs are completely full, that there's opportunities for funding to support this. So it is an equitable opportunity if schools want to participate across the board. With that, I think it would actually add a fiscal note. And happy to have future conversations about it. I just think you're a little note taker, and I know that you'll actually, like, do some follow-up on it, so wanted to plant those seeds with you. Thank you. No follow-up, Chair.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Bennett, and thank you, Representative Keeler. All of those points, I understand what you're saying. Like, because I, but like you, I have worked in the school, and whenever someone says, oh, all you have to do is just keep track of this on a little sticky note, and you're like, I have sticky notes on sticky notes. Like, I feel that, you know. The process of creating this is not final, right? This bill simply puts a working group together to talk about all the concerns that you've already brought up. And so as I told you, we have the decision makers in the room. They're listening to the questions that you're bringing up. And so as they continue to listen to our feedback, they're going to, if this becomes law, this working group will also put those into consideration so we can, you know, make sure this is as equitable as possible. For me, one of the reasons why I think this is really attractive for me is because our local schools, who know the school students the best, will be able to help make sure this is equitable and make sure that the opportunities are not something that are out of reach of for our students. As we continue with this, and we start talking to the advocates of this, we can put in some comfort language that says, hey, we need to ensure that all activities are, you know, available at whatever that looks like, and let's make sure that we talk about that. This truly is something that this, you know, as you're hearing from the students, I didn't have these opportunities when I was a kid. I didn't know anything about government or know what this looked like. My granddad was a professor of political science, and I still wasn't involved or understanding what all this meant. I go back and I look at some of the opportunities that our kids have now, and I just think that's an amazing thing that we're able to offer that. To be honest, when I first heard about it, I was like, how come we need legislation to do? But yet, here we are, we need legislation to do. So with that, Madam Chair, if there are any more questions, and I'm sure Chair Jordan would like to make a final thing, I encourage us to continue having these conversations, because I know that the coalition is very open to making sure that this isn't a situation that only a few kids get a chance to do. They want to see as much participation as possible, and they want to make sure that anyone who wants to earn a seal gets a chance to earn that seal.
Chair Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing the bill forward. I think you're right. I would have loved to have a fancy thing like this and get to do a project when I was in high school, because that was the kind of nerd I was. And I didn't grow up near a state capitol or anything else, so it would have been a good thing. One thing, I'm glad you're continuing to have conversations, and I'm glad advocates are continuing to have conversations. One thing that I do think is maybe missing from this statute language is engagement with tribal government. Minnesota is home to 11 sovereign tribal nations that all have government operations within our state boundaries that share the same geography. And so I think if we can name things like Junior ROTC, which is a great program, important, we should also name explicitly that engagement and work with tribal government is also counted. I think if we don't say that, it will leave it open to interpretation. And I think we just want to make sure that, you know, if students are engaging with their state and engaging with their tribes and their own sovereignty and learning more about that, that would be a great thing to see and see in the language. I think it's great when we say, like, of course that would happen, but we know if it's in the language, it will happen. So that would be the only other suggestion I would have. But I think it's a great bill. Thanks for working on it.
Representative Mueller, any more short final comments?
thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for all of your feedback. And thank you for the many members in this committee that are on this bill. I mean, from both sides of the aisle, I know Representative Hill, Representative Green, Representative Bierman, I think Representative Falconer, you might throw your name on there, DePell, Roach. We have so many people, even also outside of this committee, who are on that. You know, I have the privilege of working in another country, and we realize when we work in another country how unique it is for us to be able to participate in our government. And I think to be able to foster that, the way that we preserve our democratic republic is to participate in it, and to foster that I think is important. So with that, Madam Chair, I would renew my motion to have this bill laid over for future inclusion in a future honors bill.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. The chair lays over House File 2372 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or future consideration. And members, the last three bills on our agenda relate to student attendance. And you will recall we had a very good overview and discussion at previous hearing involving Representative Keeler and Representative Bakeberg. So we're going to begin with House File 62. There will be no public testimony and limited member discussion because we already did hear these bills, but we'll hear the updates here. So, Representative Keeler, please briefly remind the committee of your bill, House File 62.
Thank you, Chair and members. House File 62, this should be a quick conversation. We brought it in front of the committee at the beginning of session. This is just the landing spot of current legislation that we moved into one spot, so it's kind of easy to know how the cadence of attendance rolls. There's no new legislation, no new money, but because it is a landing spot, we would like to send this to the General Registry so we can take it to the floor and allow Bakeberg and I the opportunity to chat wonderfully about attendance.
All right.
Do you want to add anything?
All right.
She covered it.
She covered it. Okay, thank you. Let me see here, Representative Keeler. So any members, any brief comments? Because this is a pretty clear bill, I think. So thank you, Representative Keeler. Representative Keeler renews the motion that House File 62, as amended, be placed on the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. And the motion prevails. House File 62 is placed on the General Register. And the next bill will be House File 2067. Representative Keeler moves that House File 2067 be placed on the General Register. And Representative Keeler has two author's amendments. So members will first adopt the DE2 and the A1 amendments to put the bill in the shape that the author prefers. And then Representative Keeler will present the bill as amended. So let's get these done with. Representative Keeler moves that the DE1 amendment, or she moves that amendment.
DE2.
Oh, sorry. Representative Keeler moves the DE2 amendment. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the DE2 amendment is adopted. And then next, Representative Keeler moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Keeler, we got those done with, so go ahead and present your bill as amended.
Sure. Thank you, Chair and members. This bill is our best attempt to create what we're calling an attendance minibus, just to try to get some of the policy things that we've been working on over the last 9 months together as the task force. We do want to acknowledge that there's still a massive amount of work that we need to do. Representative Bakeberg and I are going to stay committed to doing this work. We've said that many times, but planning to take policy work into the interim, and as we know, we come back next year in a policy year, so you'll probably see a lot more of us and hopefully a larger crew than just Bakeberg and I talking about attendance. So to walk through the bill, now there are some areas that we know we have some testifiers coming up and some further conversation that Representative Bakeberg and I have had with other chairs. I can give those updates after we walk through the bill. So the first component of the bill, and we're looking at the DE2, this is where the A1 amendment comes on, is this is basically the reporting entity of who a parent or adult reports an absence to within the schools. We feel the language was a bit outdated. It was like school board, or school board members are saying they don't need to be the ones to receive attendance. And so, as you know, Representative Bakeberg is a principal. We've had many conversations. We believe that the principal or principal designee would be key for that. Representative Bakeberg, do you want to add anything as we go?
Yeah, I mean, Bakeberg? I would just, thank you, Madam Chair. That just, the way that we tweaked this language is just putting it in line with what actually happens in schools. School board members, that's not the role of a school board member to take attendance. Oftentimes, it's going to be an admin assistant in an office. Parent calls in, leaves a message. So that's where it's important to have that or designee in there. So it's just really putting things in line with just how things actually work in a school.
Representative Keeler, did you want to add to that?
Thank you, Chair. It's really just trusting that our principals know their staffing situations best, rather than being too prescriptive and say who those individuals were. So the next change that we're making, if you flip to the page 217 to 219, is leaning into the conversation that we have had that was part of the FAQs. It's something that Matt Shaver talked to us about, that some districts were not understanding that if a student is with a full-time employee during the time of school, they're actually not considered unexcused. And so this is just solidifying a lot of that, so that when school districts look in statute, it's very clear how an individual would be marked. We see this often if a student is with a counselor, is with a behavior coach, or even a basketball coach, something along those lines. This is just in statute saying that that would suffice attendance.
Bakeberg, did you? No? Good.
Covered
all right.
Well.
Go ahead, Representative Keeler.
Thank you. And so then the next area is more, so that's a little bit about the who we can report to and how things are determined. But then one of the really complicated pieces to this puzzle, I feel like I've been using the word puzzle a lot today and I couldn't think of another word, so we're going to roll with it, is the communication that schools have with the counties. This gets really complicated because, again, this committee doesn't have jurisdiction over the counties, but the schools are required to communicate with the counties. So what we've tried to do is create a situation, and I think the words are one thing, but I want to try to explain this in relational terms. So if you have a student that was at, we'll say, Representative Lawrence's school, at the end of last school year, I finished my seventh grade year at your school, and then we haven't had any contact with that family. So it's unexcused. It's no contact with the school for the first 15 days of the next school year. the school district would be required to immediately notify the county so that the county can quickly engage to try to find, did that student leave your district, or were they just made, do they just need more human service wraparound support services from the county? What we don't want to do, and why this language is very specific, and this is a thing Bakeberg and I have really talked about, is this is not intended for those families who are excused. So if you're a family that at the beginning of the school year, you're waiting for your IEP paperwork from your doctor before you go to school, the assumption would be that you've communicated that with the school. Therefore, you wouldn't be unexcused. You would not be sent to the county. We don't want the county involved in families that have already communicated. Or we know that some districts start earlier. If you're on a vacation with your family that's taking place and you've communicated with the school district, those are not the families that we're sending to the county to help us determine where they're at. So that's what that language really identifies.
The Bakeberg.
Yep. And just a practical piece. So at the start of this school year, we had a number of students that we had on our records. And over the course of the summer, we would get enrollment requests from schools across the state and frankly and out of state as well. So we would send the enrollment, we'd send the paperwork to that school district that requested it, and we would remove that student from our rolls. Then once we start school, we always have a handful of students who just don't show up the first day. They don't show up the second day. And then we start to wonder, okay, where is this student? And that's where we're trying to support those students and families to make sure that those kids are enrolled someplace so that they don't disappear. So.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you. So moving on the next page, so 4.7, 4.8 is just language that we inserted from another bill of mine, and I can't remember what bill number it is, but it's, were you going to tell me, 1030? Yep. I thought it was 1030. House File 1030. So what this is, we talked about the state assessment results. Adults, parents already get that information. What this bill was doing is just adding that the percentage of days that a student is absent would also be on that conversation. This leans into the conversations we've been having a lot about sort of some of the solutions are in your own home, but we need to be able to make sure that our own home has all the adequate information for us to know what's happening. If a student is failing math, maybe they're not bad at math, maybe they just keep missing math class, but if the home doesn't know that, they can't lean into that. So that's that area. Go ahead.
Representative Bakeberg.
Just to be very clear that so this idea really came as we were having a conversation about the student report and what that looks like. And, you know, wouldn't it make sense that you have MCA data for reading, math, science for, you know, fifth and eighth grade? What if we could also correlate, you know, their attendance, have an indicator, a dial of some type to show that they're actually showing up to school or to class? So that's where it's coming from. It is true. Some have said, well, Ben, isn't this data already available? Yes, it is. It is available through the student information system for parents. But to be able to connect those dots, this is just an easy way so that when I'm sitting and meeting with a family, or Representative Hill is meeting with a family about a kid struggling in class during conferences, we can correlate these two things because we have that report in the fall so that we're able to have those conversations with kids, with families, to be able to connect those dots and find some relevance for kids.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. So then the next area goes on with the reporting mechanism. This is for any student who is being dropped from the roll for unexcused absences exceeding 15 consecutive days. This is any time in the school district. This language does not say immediately, although we would like it to be as immediate as possible. We didn't want to get too prescriptive in that. But it's just, again, saying that if a student is dropped from the roll for being unexcused for 15 days consecutively, it is the school district's responsibility to notify the county. The county cannot do their job if they're not notified of the students. And then the next component of that is if the county does their due diligence and they realize that this family is no longer in the area, then they send a report to MDE. This language was actually part of a Bakeburg bill, Chair, so I'll probably send it over to him to talk a little bit more in depth about it. At the end of the day, in my mind, when we don't know where kids are at because they're not in school, honestly, at the end of the day, it just increases the likelihood that harm is also happening to our kids. And it's good for us to have a collected safety net to know where our children are at. And we are looking at MDE to be able to lean in and support that component.
Representative Bakeburg.
Yeah, and we'll take this portion of it of the bill up here in a little bit. And really, this will become the House File 1053 will become the vehicle bill for our fiscal conversations around this. But it really is getting at the 15-day drop rule. That's a fiscal rule. And oftentimes there's a tension where, you know, if we get to a point, let's say it's at the start of the year and we get to 15 days and we don't know where the kid's at, there's a concern about the health and safety of that kid, to be very direct. So, we want to make sure that we're doing our due diligence to make a report to the county or the local welfare agency. That's going to be the county. And because I have jurisdiction over like my community that I live in, like I can work with the family, work with law enforcement, you know, to make sure kids are safe. But I can't necessarily figure out if the kid moves across the county. That's the county's responsibility. So we would make a report to the county to just say, hey, we don't know where this kid is at. And then the county will try to figure out where the kid is at within the county. But there are a number of kids, and I could spend a lot of time telling you heartbreaking stories of kids that have just frankly disappeared because they leave the county. So Scott County, where I reside, they have no way to track the student down. And the only, you know, through our conversations, Representative Lawrence was a part of it, the only entity that has a statewide lens is the Department of Ed to be able to see if that kid pops up in Hennepin County or in Mille Lacs County or, you know, another county across the state. So that's the goal of it, is to figure out where these kids are, but then also provide support or wraparound support to the family. So frankly, kids are safe. It's really not that complicated of an idea.
Okay, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I think so. The last real component of that conversation is 515 to 524 is back on the Department of Education so that they would encourage re-enrollment. Kind of like Representative Bakeburg was saying, is that they're the only entity that actually can tell us if students move from one district to another. And leaning into them to make sure that we create that safety net. With that, the last component is 5.29 is where we start to have the conversation about changing how we treat children in the school. As it is right now, when you turn age 12, there's a shift in education. So if you're missing kid or you're missing school as an 11-year-old or under, you end up having like family service wraparound support if you're missing school. Like, do you have all the services you need in your home? The minute that a child turns 12, there's an assumption that it's the student's choice to just delinquently choose to miss school. And so it's a completely different path of service supports, wrapping our community arms around a student. We've had deep conversations with different counties, and they're asking us to consider moving this transition from age 12 to age 16. I think what we've learned in this conversation is, though it needs to be a critical conversation, this is where the silos happen. It's not just a school issue, though we would love it to be just a school issue. It's actually a DCYF issue. There's a child welfare issue. We have to have robust conversations. Representative Bakeburg and I have actually had, even just a couple hours ago, having conversations with our co-chairs of Children, Youth, and Family, understanding that they oversee DCYF, and that's where a lot of these new statutes lie. Deeply complicated to try to overlap where this goes. And so I'm open to have conversation about this, but Chair, I think for sure we're going to be striking this language with the understanding that Representative Bakeberg and I will be partnering with DCYF staff to have a more robust conversation and hope to bring something back next year, but would hope that we could at least open up the floor to have conversations about that before we make the motion to remove it. With that, Chair, that's the entire bill and the changes that we've made. Representative Bakeberg, do you want to wrap anything up before testifiers or other testifiers?
I think we're good to move to testifiers.
Okay, we do want to get to your last attendance bill too, but I will make that motion, Representative Keeler, after the testifiers. So members, we do have some testifiers. Reminder that we ask the testifiers to state their name and organization for the record, and also ask you to keep your comments to 2 minutes. So let's start with Matt Shaver. Go ahead and state your name for the record and begin.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Matt Shaver. I am the Senior Policy Director at Allies. We're Education Advocates for Kids. Thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts on the DE amendment this afternoon to House File 2067. I want to thank Representative Bakeberg and Keeler for their ongoing steadfast work in this area. Want to just briefly touch on a couple of things that have been discussed here. I'm going to throw some numbers at everybody, so if you want to write them down, that would be awesome. The numbers are 25, 199, 3, and 16. So this is why we're here. 25 is the percent of Minnesota students who are chronically absent in the most recent year we have data for school. 199 is 199,000 students, is what that percentage represents. 3 is 3 million combined days of school that were missed by the chronically absent students that we had in Minnesota. And 16 is the 16 million hours of combined instructional time that was missed by chronically absent students in Minnesota. That's why we're here. As a teacher, I have a lot of sympathy for folks in the room who are working to learn the vocabulary. I'm working to learn the vocabulary of how do we have a better response to our attendance challenges in the state. So just an incomplete list of things that we need to know and understand to make sensible attendance policy so we have a better response to students who are struggling with attendance. So here's a list. Excused absences, unexcused absences, tardies, chronic absenteeism, habitual truancy, educational neglect, truant, and the 15-day drop. So in order to make sensible policy and better address when students are struggling with attendance, we need to have really clear definitions and understanding in a bipartisan way, in a way that can work statewide, to help students and their families and schools break down silos between district, school, home, family, and state, and county, so that we aren't losing track of kids, so that students who are struggling with attendance, they have a set of interventions. Students who are getting involved with county have a set of interventions, and students where we really have an edge case where they are being essentially, because of the 15-day drop policy, kicked out of the plane and figuring out where that safety net is for kids. This bill and the policies that are here before us are steps to try and address elements of each of those pieces. These are the low-hanging fruit policies that we can do right now, and some of these pieces of fruit are on the floor. Okay, but we can't have, as somebody who has a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old in your house, you can't have a tidy house if you don't pick up the pieces of fruit off the floor after a dinner, okay? So we have to do the good basic work that's done right here, and that's what this bill represents. I really, really want to focus and think about in my last couple of seconds here this piece around unenrollment and who is responsible for students after 15 consecutive missed days of school. The State Department of Education is that one entity who sees across all 87 counties, okay? They are the one safety net that is left at that point. Without them, we have a system that depends on individual people being superheroes. Our kids need more from us than building a system that looks like that, okay? We need cohesive responses to attendance problems in the state, and this bill is an absolute set of steps in the right direction for that. So I want to thank you all for your time and your service to the state.
Thank you. Next, we have Ashley Hightower. And when you're settled in there, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Ashley Hightower. I'm with Hennepin County Attorney's Office, Be at School program. We're the largest educational neglect and truancy program in Minnesota. I always like to give an update. To date, as a couple of seconds ago, we were at 7,167 referrals. I'd like to start with reviewing the presumptions regarding truancy or educational neglect. The statute currently creates inequities on how interventions at the county level are being implemented. Currently, this is a court hearing statute that presumes a child's absence from school is the caretaker's responsibility if the child is under 12 and the school has made appropriate efforts to resolve the child's attendance problems. But once a student turns 12, the absent is presumed to be the child's intent to miss school. Be at School is advocating for the presumption of truancy age be moved to 16. This is based on the age in Minnesota when a youth can authorize their own mental health services. The solution is not to send all these cases then to child protection. We know they're really struggling with the volume and numbers. The thought is to not petition a 12 to 15 year old to court for struggling with attendance. A habitual truant is a child in need of protection and services. Other examples under that statute are children abandoned without a parent or guardian, victims of physical or sexual abuse, without necessary food, clothing, or shelter, medical neglect, and sexually exploited youth. These students are not being petitioned to court, but given resources and supports needed to ensure their basic needs are being met. Be at School is a diversion program, and we work to address the underlying barriers to attendance prior to child protection, referral, or a truancy court intervention. We partner with community agencies and schools for early intervention and supports. Just really quick, in 2021, our program forwarded 752 students to child protection for additional services. Last year, we were at 369, and this year, we're only at 216. We also currently do not practice truancy court as one of our interventions. We're reducing the number of students entering the child protection and juvenile court systems with community supports and school engagement. By shifting to supportive interventions, we can better serve the whole child and their family. We're so in need of a public awareness campaign to focus on educating families, schools, and communities about the importance of consistent attendance and resources available. And we need to work on connecting families and schools to tools and services to address barriers rather than punitive solutions. Just really quick, the Minnesota survey, reasons students miss school. Our students are reporting not enough sleep, missing the bus, not feeling safe at home, having to take care of family members, and feeling stressed, hopeless, and angry. The barriers listed are those that the adults in the room can help address prior to county involvement. The survey also comes from 2022. This is because this is the most updated report the department has available for us, which leads to my next crucial change, reports to the state or county. This proposed change will require districts to report non-compliant students to counties for services and follow-up. This ensures students don't fall through the cracks and when their 15-day dropped. This year, we're currently at 601 students that have been 15-day dropped. I know that each of those students is tied to a dollar amount as well. The proposed change to have this information 15 days after the beginning of each academic term gets us a lot closer to real-time data because we really can't live years behind in our data results and expect those impactful changes. We also have working on a bill that would bring Minnesota IT services, departments, counties, school districts, school board, you name it, all together to identify those barriers to attendance data sharing and determine the technical requirements for real-time data that would help remove those silos we've all been talking about. Information sharing needs to be done at a quicker pace. Delays in the communication and data process should not be a barrier once again for our students. Again, thank you for your time, for me listening to me speak today. I look forward to having these conversations with many of you. Please reach out if you have any questions or want any additional data. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Megan Adiola. When you're ready, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Megan Adiola, and I serve as the Legislative Policy Manager for the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you for letting me take the opportunity to make a few comments on the DE2 amendment and this subject as a whole. I want to say clearly and explicitly for the committee, MDE is committed to working on making Minnesota schools places where students feel like they belong and places that they feel like they want to be. The students that came to this legislative study group made one thing absolutely clear. If students don't feel like school is welcoming, if students don't feel like school is safe or engaging, they don't want to go, and they won't go. And we also know this work is going to take time, and we also know that this work requires some immediate action. So knowing that the work as setting us up to build momentum toward our shared goals of educating kids in safe, welcoming environments with caring and qualified teachers and staff. And we know that the issues being addressed here today, we do want to address with some immediacy. So as the statewide education agency, MDE is a resource hub and a support partner for districts and schools to set the groundwork, providing students more direct engagement, offering best practice and guidance around building that adult and student trust, connecting districts and counties with others in the field to share what is working in similarly situated schools, counties, and organizations. This is all work that MDE staff is doing today. When it comes to the real work of providing students that crucial one-on-one adult-to-student connection that is absolutely instrumental to a successful re-enrollment and readmission plan, setting MDE as the party responsible for providing these adults to provide direct case management for individual students may not set that student up with the immediate and consistent access to that trusted adult that they need to succeed. As has been addressed under the current language, Section 6 has been identified as carrying a cost to the department, and I do understand that that section is going to move as part of HF 1053, so I appreciate the representatives addressing that concern. We know that there are a lot of great ideas being thrown around and considered by the legislature right now and about how to bring, what is the best path forward to bring unenrolled students back and keep them engaged and retain them. And we look forward to continuing to be a partner in these conversations. I have very much appreciated the amount of space that MDE has been able to provide feedback and just some implementation realities. We understand that these are hard conversations that adults need to be having. And we look forward to continuing to be in that. We want to discuss the best legislative path forward to address these issues and what can be done to get those students back in the classroom consistently. So thank you for the focus on attendance and that not only the representatives, but the committee as a whole has taken on this year. MDE is ready for those conversations, remains an enthusiastic partner, and I am, of course, available for questions if members have them. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next, we'll have member discussion. Members, we have about 8 minutes until we need to get to the next bill just to get that through as well. But do we have any discussion here on what you've heard? Much of it we've heard before. And thank you to both our representatives here for working together and coming up with this plan. Any members? Representative Lawrence?
Madam Chair, thank you so much. Representative Baker, Representative Keeler, as a member of the task force, I just wanted to kind of state that I think Representative Keeler and Baker have done a great job of taking our buckets of puzzle pieces and starting to put the puzzle together. And as a member of the task force, this really starts to address many of those different issues, not all together, not all of them at once, but it starts to take part of us, put them together. And so I just want to say thank you.
Hey, Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate that. Thank you, Representative Bakeberg and Representative Keeler. I love that you guys have just dove into all this work and just really appreciate it. Very grateful for the work that you have done. I just have a question about MDE. I don't know if MDE, if Megan can come back up. Thank you so much.
Go ahead and ask your question, Representative Green.
And maybe just because I would love to just know a little bit more about the reporting structure and what happens when MDE right now, if MDE finds out that it gets an attendance report, what happens next? I guess I just need to understand a little bit more about that so I can understand the bills that are being addressed. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Adeola. If you could kind of give a high level, but answer the question, thank you.
Madam Chair, you anticipated my answer, which is that I would love to talk about all of the different flows of data and how that gets to MDE and when. I apologize for the record. Again, my name is Megan Adeola, the Legislative Policy Manager at MDE. But what the existing structure is, when school districts are reporting their attendance to us, it is reported as an aggregate of hours of instruction. So it's often reported for the purpose of ADM funding and the various other funding streams that rely on a measure of daily attendance. So what we receive is there's 165 hours of instruction. Students, I believe it's broken down into like the student body's attendance was this much hours, you know, broken down into further. My high school statistics teacher is probably somewhere out there being very frustrated because I can't remember if it's the median or the mean, the average number for that student, and then the individual results of that student's attendance are logged into a system, but that comes later because the most important thing that they log to us more with more immediacy is the hours of instruction so that they can appropriately access their ADM.
Representative Green.
Thank you so much, Chair. Okay, so it's I guess what I'm just trying to get my head around. So it sounds like when a student comes, we're talking about like the ADM, the funding, the hours, all of that. But I guess like what happens to the kid? Like, is there an effort from MDE within these bills that you see that we can get that reported so that we know all and the systems can talk to each other? And because to me, that's the immediacy more than the ADM is the kid, you know. So thank you,
Ms. Ariola.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Green. This, I think, has opened up a very interesting conversation that for a lot of our staff, we feel is probably bigger than I think just attendance, is how much of what schools report on is being reported for the purposes of their school funding versus the purposes of some of this other data that has been expressed that folks would like more access to. Because as was mentioned, we know that districts submit a lot of data. Districts have a lot of data. It moves through various channels with whatever existing structures are in place. But we also know that when it comes to some of these more nuanced conversations for the 20th century, the conversation around how much is tied to funding versus other ways to determine ADM and student participation in class, I think is you're seeing a larger conversation at the legislature through a number of other bills. So I will just say that is a 21st century conversation that we are very much interested in having and want to continue to engage to just, you know, recognize that education is very different in a lot of ways from what a lot of people have become accustomed to. So that's my answer of we're in it.
Okay. And Representative Green, would you be willing to take any further questions about that offline?
Absolutely. I'm just going to say thank you.
Thank you. Thank you much. And Chair Jordan has graciously agreed to let us move right on to the oral amendments to get through and get to our next bill. And thank you for that. So Representative Keeler moves to strike Section 7 of the DE2 amendment, which was adopted to House File 2067. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the oral amendment is adopted. Are we good with that, members? Keep moving? Thank you. Okay, thank you. And Representative Keeler renews the motion that House... Oh, I'm sorry, final comments by our authors here. Any final comments, or?
We were on a roll with cutting things out, I guess.
Okay.
I mean, if we could just get away.
That sounds good. Thank you. I didn't want to cut you off, so you two have done great work. So Representative Keeler renews the motion that House File 2067, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Whoa.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. We do have a couple more oral amendments.
Oh, all right. We better back up. So
the... Re-enroll. So
the 1053 piece.
Okay. Well, there's two. So back to what MDE reported, that the re-enroll portion of MDE would cost money in the efforts of keeping this policy only. We would do line item 515, well, it's section 6, so 513 to 524 eliminates the agency component that they're saying has a cost. We would be moving that over we'd be picking that up in Vakeburg's bill. So we need to remove that out of this as an oral amendment. Then there's a second one.
Okay. So I didn't catch the numbers there. Do you want to just, Section 6?
Section 6.
Okay, so Representative Keeler moves to strike Section 6 of the DE2 amendment. Is that correct? Which was adopted to House File 2067. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the oral amendment is adopted. And is there one more oral amendment yet? Representative Keeler or Bakeberg, whoever.
Could we approach the bench? No, I'm just
kidding. I feel like you're watching our brains work.
So, just in the spirit of transparency, there's some question about 4.7 and 4.8. If there's a cost there, now, I'll be honest. My preference is that cost would be absorbed, and we just move forward. So, but I just wanted to make sure that we're being very clear. So we're just going to move forward is what I'm seeing heads nodding at the front. And
Chair Jordan, are you okay with keeping that in?
Madam Chair, I'm okay with keeping lines 4.7 and 4.8.
So we're good to go there. All righty. So I think we're ready. I'm just going to call you Representatives Dynamic Duo. Then we don't need either name. So Representative Keeler renews the motion that House File 2067 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails and House File 2067 as amended is placed on the general register. All righty. Members, the last bill on the agenda is House File 1053, which the committee heard and laid over on February 25th, 2025. This should be pretty short here. Representative Keeler and Representative Bakeberg continue to work on additional student attendance provisions that might have fiscal considerations. So therefore, we're going to send House File 1053 to the Education Finance Committee as a possible vehicle for those solutions. So the chair moves that House File 1053 be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails and House File 1053 is re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. Well, members, look at that. We have 2 minutes left here and we're done. So that concludes today's agenda. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, March 26th. And with that, the committee stands adjourned.